Pennsylvanian owl, all agree that if they had their own radios, they would tune in to CFRC 101.9 FM. Broadcasting just for you from Kingston, Ontario, Canada.
Monday. When traffic's a nightmare. When the workplace is hectic. When your boss calls you in for a meeting. When nature isn't on your side. There's only one thing you can do.
But no need to wake up the neighbors. Tune in every Monday night from 11 p.m. to midnight for Shed Progressions, where we play an hour of cool jazz to help you relax after a long day. Again, that's Shed Progressions every Monday night at 11 p.m. on CFRC 101.9 FM.
We're not afraid to get a little funky.
Is Democracy Now.
If this reckless deal is approved and implemented, the Jewish Power Party will give the resignation letter to the Prime Minister. The Jewish Power Party will not be part of the government and will withdraw from it.
Israel's far-right ministers threaten to resign if the Israeli cabinet approves the ceasefire deal with Hamas. We'll get the latest from Haaretz columnist Gideon Levy and Middle East analyst Muin Rabbani. Then to President-elect Trump's billionaire inauguration, with Jeff Bezos, Mark Zuckerberg, and Elon Musk all joining Trump on the dais Monday. We'll speak with Public Citizen's Craig Holman. His new report, Billionaires, Millionaires, and Lobbyists Cozy Up to Trump by Flooding the Inauguration with Record-Breaking Donations. Then, in his final days as president, Biden makes history with a record number of commutations. Will he pardon Indigenous leader Leonard Peltier? Among those calling for his clemency is the man who prosecuted Peltier, former U.S. Attorney James Reynolds.
President Joe Biden, I write today from a position rare for a former prosecutor to beseech you to commute the sentence of a man who I helped to put behind bars.
Reynolds put Leonard Peltier behind bars half a century ago. Now Peltier is 80 and in ailing health. We'll speak to activist Nick Tilson about Native American leaders' final push for Biden to grant Peltier clemency. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel's war cabinet and government is convening to vote on the long-awaited Gaza ceasefire agreement. Two far-right Israeli cabinet ministers, Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich and Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir, have voiced opposition to the deal, with Ben-Gvir threatening to quit if it's passed. As Palestinians await confirmation the deal's been secured, Israel continues its deadly attacks across Gaza. Over 113 Palestinians have been killed since the truce was announced Wednesday, at least 28 of them children. This is Sami Abu Tahoun, a displaced child living in Al-Nusrat camp.
I only wish to return to Gaza City for one reason. I wish to see my father again. Since our displacement, I lost something essential in my life, the presence of a father. When my mother asked me to go pray, I refused because I wanted to pray with my father. We hope the war will end next Sunday, as they say in the meetings.
If approved, the ceasefire deal will go into effect Sunday, including the release of the first hostages. We'll get latest on ceasefire after headlines. Israeli troops have carried out another day of raids across the occupied West Bank. On Thursday, Israeli forces raided the Askar refugee camp, shooting and wounding three Palestinian teens. Separately, Israeli military vehicles entered the grounds of the Arab Evangelical Hospital in Nablus and took up positions in the courtyard. Overnight, Israeli soldiers raided the Tulkarem refugee camp, where there were reports of gunfire and clashes with Palestinian fighters. This all follows an Israeli airstrike on the city of Jenin Wednesday that killed six Palestinians and left scores injured. On Thursday, mourners held funeral processions for the dead, even as they welcomed the Gaza ceasefire deal.
The Jenin refugee camp was supporting the Gaza people during the 15 months war on Gaza, and thus we expect calmer times for Jenin.
Since October 2023, near daily Israeli raids on the West Bank have killed nearly 800 Palestinians and injured 6,700 others. Over 14,000 have been arrested. Outgoing Secretary of State Antony Blinken was confronted by two journalists as he delivered his final news conference at the State Department Thursday. The Gray Zone's editor, Max Blumenthal, disrupted Blinken just minutes into his address to reporters.
You wave the white flag before Netanyahu.
We'll have the time to take questions at the end.
You wave the white flag before Israeli fascists.
We'll have the time to take questions at the end.
Your father-in-law was an Israel lobbyist. Your grandfather was an Israel lobbyist. Are you compromised by Israel? Why did you allow the Holocaust of our time to happen. How does it feel to have your legacy be genocide? How does it feel to have your legacy be genocide? You too, Matt. You smirk through the whole thing every day. You smirk through a genocide.
Blumenthal was addressing State Department spokesperson Matt Miller at the end of the video. Matt Miller then ordered security to preemptively remove independent journalist Sam Husseini, forcing him to shout his questions to Blinken towards the stage as he was forcibly carried out of the room, then handcuffed.
Everybody from Amnesty International, to the ICJ is saying that Israel's doing genocide and extermination, and you're telling me to respect the process. Criminal! Why aren't you in the Hague?
Right before the journalists confronted the Secretary of State, Blinken thanked the press for, quote, asking tough questions. Earlier this week, a ProPublica report detailed the Biden administration's repeated pattern of issuing empty threats and warnings to Israel over the past 15 months, allowing Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu to dismiss any red lines from Washington while continuing his genocide in Gaza with impunity. Senate confirmation hearings continued Thursday for Trump's cabinet nominees. Scott Bessent, nominated for Treasury Secretary, advocated for more deregulation and higher tariffs and opposed increasing the federal minimum wage. Bessent also called for extending Trump's 2017 tax cuts, which is projected to add $4 trillion to the federal deficit.
This is the single most important economic issue of the day. This is pass-fail. That if we do not fix these tax cuts, if we do not renew and extend, then we will be facing an economic calamity.
Trump's pick to lead the Interior Department, former North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum, praised Trump's agenda of so-called energy dominance, but vowed to, quote, follow the law and follow the Constitution. Former New York Congressmember Lee Zeldin, nominated to lead the EPA, asserted, quote, I believe that climate change is real, unquote, but would not commit to regulating greenhouse gases if he's confirmed. Meanwhile, in Florida, Governor Ron DeSantis named Florida Attorney General Trump loyalist Ashley Moody to fill Marco Rubio's Senate seat. Rubio is expected to be confirmed as the next Secretary of State. Miami Herald reports Moody sued the Biden administration 9 times since 2023, including on immigration policy, transgender rights, COVID-19 policies, and student debt relief. Rudy Giuliani has settled with two Georgia election workers he was found guilty of defaming. The deal allows Giuliani to avoid a trial and keep his apartment in New York and condo in Florida in exchange for an undisclosed payment to Ruby Freeman and Shea Moss and his pledge not to further defame the two women. The mother-daughter duo welcomed the opportunity to, quote, move forward with our lives, unquote, after the deal was reached, calling the last 4 years a living nightmare. In California, some mandatory evacuation zones around Los Angeles have been reopened after firefighters made significant gains battling two massive wildfires. As of Thursday evening, the Palisades fire was 27% contained, the Eaton fire 55% contained. Officially, the death toll from the fire stands at 27. But a new study by Yale University's Climate Connections predicts that toxic smoke combined with disruption to the economy and health may lead to thousands of deaths over the coming years. It's already the costliest wildfire event in California history. A report from Wells Fargo and Goldman Sachs estimates the cost to insurers alone could reach as much as $30 billion. On Thursday, dozens of climate activists with the Sunrise Movement held a protest outside a Phillips 66 terminal in Los Angeles demanding oil companies pay up for the wildfires and other climate catastrophes. Last year, oil and gas interests successfully campaigned to kill a California bill that would have forced polluters to help pay to help cover the cost of climate disasters. Meanwhile, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has blamed the fossil fuel industry for the devastating wildfires in Los Angeles, linking them to the broader climate crisis. In a speech Guterres gave to the UN General Assembly on Wednesday.
Look no further than the hills of Los Angeles. It has gone from the home of disaster movies to a scene of disaster. Who pays the price for climate destruction around the world? Not the fossil fuel industry, pocketing profits and taxpayer subsidies as their products wreck havoc. Every people suffer.
The U.S. has announced sanctions against the chief of Sudan's armed forces, General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan. The Treasury Secretary accused Sudan's military of lethal attacks on civilians, including the use of chemical weapons and the denial of humanitarian aid. This comes just days after the Biden administration imposed sanctions on Sudan's rival paramilitary group, the Rapid Support Forces, and a week after accusing the RSF of committing genocide. The UN says more than 150,000 people have been killed since fighting erupted April 2023. 11 million people have fled their homes while famine has spread to at least five regions. Earlier this week, a local volunteer network said over 120 people were killed during shelling in Abdurrahman, the twin city of Sudan's capital, Khartoum. In the U.S., an Ohio woman who was charged with felony abuse of a corpse after having a miscarriage has filed a federal lawsuit against the hospital and healthcare providers who treated her, as well as the police and the city of Warren for their role in criminalizing her pregnancy loss. In 2023, Brittany Watts was denied abortion care at 22 weeks pregnant, despite being told her fetus was not viable and that she was at risk of hemorrhaging and sepsis. She miscarried at home several days later and was criminally charged 2 weeks later after a hospital worker reported her to police, falsely claiming she improperly disposed of the remains of her pregnancy. President Biden is making history, commuting the sentences of nearly 2,500 federal prisoners convicted of nonviolent drug offenses. The order will benefit people who received harsher punishments than they would have under modern sentencing laws and practices, including those given lengthy sentences based on distinctions between crack and powder cocaine. Biden has now issued more individual pardons and commutations than any other U.S. president. And the meatpacking companies Purdue Farms and JBS will pay $8 million for exploiting immigrant children who worked in their slaughterhouses after reaching a settlement with the Labor Department. The companies came under scrutiny in recent years after a series of reports revealed unaccompanied youth, mostly from Mexico and Central America, are being maimed and burned while working at meat plants, often on graveyard shifts. Federal law prohibits children from working in slaughterhouses due to dangerous conditions. The money will go to the children as well as organizations that assist them, including kids in need of defense. And this latest news, the Israeli Security Cabinet has approved the ceasefire and hostage deal. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today's show on the long-awaited ceasefire deal between Israel and Hamas. Israel's security cabinet has just voted to recommend the full cabinet approve the proposed ceasefire and hostage release agreement. A government meeting intended to grant final approval will be convened possibly even as we broadcast this program. If approved, the ceasefire is expected to go into effect Sunday. Three hostages are also expected to be released Sunday afternoon. The Israeli cabinet vote was initially expected on Thursday, but was delayed by widening rifts with Israel's governing coalition. Two far-right ministers in the government, Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich and Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir, are threatening to resign if the deal is passed. This is Israel's National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir urging Prime Minister Netanyahu to reject the agreement with Hamas.
The willingness to pay heavy prices for the release of hostages also exists with us. We are ready to do anything that will lead to their release, provided that the price does not include a much heavier price than what happened on the 7th of October. The existing deal increases Hamas's appetite and motivation. This deal is letting them attack, explode, and kidnap, and get what they want.
Meanwhile, Gaza remains under relentless attack. Over 113 Palestinians have been killed in Israeli strikes since the announcement of the ceasefire deal on Wednesday. At least 28 of them were children, 31 women.
The repercussion and effects of the war, especially the psychological impact on us, women, and our children, will be the most challenging issue. The war was long, and what we witnessed during it was unprecedented.
For the latest on the ceasefire and hostage release, we're joined by two guests. Gideon Levy is an award-winning Israeli journalist, author, columnist for the newspaper Haaretz, member of its editorial board. His new article, Free All Hostages, Israeli and Palestinian. Levy's latest book, The Killing of Gaza, reports on a catastrophe. And we're joined by Muin Rabbani, Middle East analyst, co-editor of Jadalaya, and host of the Connections podcast. He's a former senior analyst for the International Crisis Group, contributor to the book Deluge, Gaza and Israel from Crisis to Cataclysm. Gideon, you're in Tel Aviv. Let's begin with you. As we broadcast right now, the security cabinet, the war cabinet, has just voted for the ceasefire deal. It now goes to the larger cabinet. Explain the significance of this and the resistance.
No significance at all, because the first phase will be implemented from Sunday. Those are rituals, but once Netanyahu decided that he's willing to go for the first phase of the deal, this phase will go to its way. The main challenge will be the second phase. And here there are many, many problems in the horizon. But right now we are going through the motions, the cabinet and then the government, and two ministers will speak against it, and all the others will be in favor of it. And Sunday, the first hostages are going to be released.
And talk about the piece that you wrote, your new article, All Hostages, Israeli and Palestinian. They're saying there will free all hostages, Israeli and Palestinian. They're saying over this first period of 42 days in the ceasefire phases, 33 hostages will be released. They're talking about Israeli hostages. A few of them are American. Not as much is said about the, what, something like 1,000 Palestinians. Talk about who they are.
So part of them are terrorists, murderers, who sit decades and decades in jail for things that they've been doing in their early days and really paid their role, paid their price in jail. Part of them are political prisoners, don't be mistaken. And part of them are hostages. Israel had captured in Gaza, we don't know the exact figure, hundreds and maybe thousands of Palestinians. They are being held in horrible conditions. I don't want to compare to the conditions of the of the hostages, the Israeli hostages, but I'm not sure that they are being held in better conditions and maybe even worse conditions. We don't know enough. But in any case, in inhuman conditions, really inhuman, Haaretz had revealed in the last weeks some really information which nobody can remain indifferent. And they are not counted at all. Nobody cares about them. They don't have families. Nobody's happy about them. Nobody cares about them. They are not part of the international discourse, while they are also human beings, part of them terrorists, but also terrorists have some rights, you know. Even the Nukba, who did those horrible things on the 7th of October, has some rights, and they don't get the rights. So in any case, I'm thrilled. I'm really shivering when I think about the Israeli hostages, but I cannot help it. There is also a huge number of Palestinian hostages, and they deserve also some freedom.
Would you say that Israel is rounding up more and more? We're talking about thousands in this year-long Israel's war on Gaza, so that they would release them as part of a deal to get the hostages out, the Israeli hostages out.
First of all, I'm not sure they will be released in this deal. Right now, those who are candidates to be released are long-standing or long-sitting prisoners of decades who did all kinds of terrible things in the 80s, in the 90s, and now will be released. Others are even criminal prisoners. I'm not sure that those from Gaza will be released now. And the thing is that Israel is really complaining, very rightly so, about the conditions, about the fact that the International Red Cross does not visit the Israeli hostages, about the fact that their families don't know if they are alive or not. The same is valid about the Palestinian prisoners and hostages. And therefore, I call to remember that there are also some others. We are not alone. Again and again, Israelis always think that they are the only victims. No.
Moin Rabbani, we want to get your response to what's happening right now. We saw the images of people in Gaza erupting in celebration at the news of a ceasefire. We see the heartbreaking interviews with Israeli hostage families who's demanding that Netanyahu sign the deal. We don't see that same intimate interviews with people on the streets in Gaza talking about what they've lost because the Israeli government bans all international journalists from being on the ground in Gaza, though Democracy Now! Does interview people in Gaza. Can you talk about the significance of this and how this came about? President Biden saying this is my deal, though giving a nod to President Trump, and Trump saying he's ungracious and not saying it was his envoy that sealed this deal, that forced his ally, Netanyahu, to finally sign off on the ceasefire.
Well, it's quite clear that Biden had next to nothing to do with this deal. This is a deal that was formulated by Netanyahu and presented on his behalf by Biden in May of last year and was accepted by Hamas in early July of last year. And the primary missing element has been Israel's agreement to this text. And the only reason that Israel did not agree to this text until this week is because it didn't have to worry about U.S. pressure. What it in fact had was unconditional U.S. support and U.S. Collusion. And it's quite clear that the only thing that has changed in the past month is that there was a unambiguous message from the incoming Trump team to Netanyahu that they do not want to have to deal with the Middle East, with a foreign policy crisis during the inauguration and on their first day in office. And they especially don't want to deal with a crisis that includes American hostages in the Middle East. They want to be Ronald Reagan in 1981, not Jimmy Carter. And I think Netanyahu...
And explain what you mean by that, Moin.
Well, I'm referring to the Iranian hostage crisis that is considered a large contributor to Jimmy Carter's election loss in 1980, and that those American hostages were not released until after Carter had left the White House and Reagan had entered it. And Trump very clearly does not want to be a Carter. He wants to be a Reagan in this respect. Netanyahu understood the message loud and clear. And so he signed on the dotted line. You know, we've had all this drama and theatrics of the past 2 days that Gideon Levy was just talking about, but it was never in doubt, particularly because I think Netanyahu is now hoping that with Trump so narrowly focused on January 20th, that he'll lose interest within a few weeks, and Netanyahu will then be able to scuttle the deal when it gets to when the first phase ends, because as Gideon Levy mentioned, the second stage is still being negotiated and is yet to be finalized.
And talk about that second stage, though, what we understand and what Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, and also talk about their histories, and even with the Israeli government, them being gone after for example, terrorism. But if you can talk about what their objections are when it comes to the Israeli military in Gaza.
Well, they share, in fact, Netanyahu's objections. One of Netanyahu's previous... So again, we need to recall this is not an American initiative. This is an initiative that, according to Biden, was formulated by Netanyahu and merely presented by the Americans. And what happened after it was presented and after it was accepted by Hamas in July, Netanyahu began adding new conditions that Israel would have to retain a permanent presence in the so-called Netzarim corridor, bisecting the Gaza Strip, the so-called Philadelphia corridor, abutting the Egyptian border, and most importantly, that there could be no formal end to hostilities. In other words, there would be no definitive ceasefire. So it seems that Netanyahu's expectation was that Hamas would sign an agreement that would oblige it to release all the Israeli captives and hostages, and then accept that once the last one was released, Israel could resume its genocidal campaign against the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. Clearly, a condition designed to be rejected. Smotrich and Ben-Gvir are insisting that they cannot accept any deal that ends Israel's military campaign in the Gaza Strip. And what they've said is they're against this deal. Ben-Gvir will leave the government. They will vote against it. But they will continue to support Netanyahu against any no-confidence measures. And that if and when Netanyahu resumes this genocidal campaign, they will rejoin. They will rejoin the government. So it's really a very, very empty threat. I see it as pure theater.
This is President-elect Trump's national security advisor nominee Mike Waltz in an interview with Fox and Friends Thursday, following news that the Prime Minister Netanyahu was again delaying the vote to approve the Gaza ceasefire and hostage deal.
No one has done more for Israel than President Trump. We will have their back to make sure Hamas never exists as a terrorist state and certainly does not govern Gaza.
Your response to that, Muin Rabbani?
Well, Israel has been at it for 15 months and still has a very long way to go. And if one assumes that it's virtually impossible for the Trump administration to provide more and more unconditional support to Israel than Biden has, I'm not quite sure what he means by that. Secondly, in terms of so-called post-war governance scenarios, because Hamas has survived, it will be impossible to impose any government or administration on the Gaza Strip that does not have the consent of Hamas. Hamas doesn't need to be included in that and may well prefer not to be included. but it does require its consent. You know, and this is, I would say, a typical American politician making extravagant statements about what they're about to achieve. But, you know, reality tends to bite pretty hard once these people get into office.
I want to turn to what happened at the State Department yesterday. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, with his farewell news conference, had two journalists forcibly removed from his final press briefing after they questioned him on the Biden administration's policies in Gaza. This is the exchange between Blinken and Max Blumenthal, editor of The Gray Zone.
300 reporters in Gaza were on the receiving end of your bombs. Why did you keep the bombs flowing when we had a deal in May? We all knew we had a deal. Everyone in this room knows we had a deal, Tony, and you kept the bombs flowing. Why did you sacrifice the rules-based order on the mantle of your commitment to Zionism? Why did you allow my friends to be massacred? Why did you allow my friends' homes in Gaza to be destroyed when we had a deal in May? You helped destroy our religion, Judaism, by associating it with fascism. You waved the white flag before Netanyahu.
We'll have the time to take questions at the end.
You waved the white flag before Israeli fascism.
We'll have the time to take questions at the end.
Your father-in-law was an Israel lobbyist. Your grandfather was an Israel lobbyist. Are you compromised by Israel? Why did you allow the Holocaust of our time to happen? How does it feel to have your legacy be genocide? How does it feel to have your legacy be genocide? You too, Matt. You smirk through the whole thing every day.
A few minutes later, the independent journalist Sam Husseini was also dragged out of the room as he shouted out.
Finally, I just wanted to share this morning.
Get your hands off me. Get your hands off me. Get your hands off me. Answer a damn question.
I look forward to answering questions in 2 minutes.
You know about Israel's nuclear weapons. Everybody from the ICJ, I was sitting here quietly, and now I'm being manhandled by two or three people. You pontificate about a free press. Sir, you pontificate about a free press. You are hurting me. I am asking questions after being told by Matt Miller that he will not answer my questions until I'm asked.
Please, sir, respect the process. We'll have an opportunity to take questions
the
in 2 minutes.
Wasn't the point of May 31st sir, statement to block the ICJ orders? You blocked the ICJ orders?
Please, sir, respect the process. Thank you.
Oh, respect the process. Respect the process. While everybody from Amnesty International, to the ICJ is saying that Israel's doing genocide and extermination, and you're telling me to respect the process. Criminal! Why aren't you in the Hague?
Journalist Sam Husseini was being taken out even before he asked a question. They had gathered around him as Max Blumenthal was taken out. Gideon Levy, if you can respond to journalists breaking the kind of consensus at the State Department and challenging Antony Blinken, the Secretary of State.
I wish there would have been more. I wish there would have been journalists like this in Israel, which you hardly see. Blinken is a typical American liberal, like the Yair Lapids and the Benny Gantz and the Israeli Zionist leftists or the Israeli liberals. They have very clear borders to what should be said and what shouldn't be said. They always say the right things and do exactly the opposite. Blinken cannot break away from his accountability to what is happening in Gaza. Blinken and Biden, they say the most noble things about humanitarian aid, about the right of the Palestinians to live in peace and to have their own rights, beautiful things. In the same time, they finance, they armed this horrible weapon, this horrible war, without putting any conditions to Israel. And they will be judged not according their nice talkings, but according to their policy and their actions. And their actions lead only to one conclusion. What happened in Gaza, which is quite clear already that it is totally criminal, has two main responsible factors. One is obviously the Israeli leadership. And the second one is the American administration and no beautiful talkings will release Blinken and Biden from their responsibility to 20, 30,000 killed children and babies and women, 50, 60, maybe 70,000 people killed in Gaza, total destruction by American weapons which were delivered to Israel without putting any condition to Israel. That's the reality. And Max Blumenthal and others try to call the bluff and try to say the truth. And I'm very sorry that their voice is not legitimate.
Mouin Rabbani, your final comment on this ceasefire deal that's being approved by the Israeli government as we speak, the hostage and ceasefire deal, at least for 42 days, what this means for the overall region?
Well, it's not a political agreement, and it's certainly not one that addresses the underlying causes of the crisis that erupted in October of 2023. This is a very limited agreement to deal with a very specific issue, namely a ceasefire in the Gaza Strip and an Israeli-Palestinian exchange of captives and hostages. And it's a very fragile one, precisely for the reasons enumerated by Gideon Levy, that I believe Netanyahu will do everything possible with collusion of certain Trump officials to try to scuttle it after the first phase. At the same time, I think the most that can be hoped for at this stage is a return to the U.S. policy of strategic neglect of the question of Palestine. But let's recall that's what got us into this mess in the first place.
Mouin Rabbani, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Middle East analyst, co-editor of Jadalia, host of the Connections podcast, and Gideon Levy, award-winning Israeli journalist and member of the editorial board of the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, speaking to us from Tel Aviv. Coming up, Trump's billionaire inauguration. Stay with us.
Song I made, you'd say it's not your taste. If anyone else but me wrote it, it's a masterpiece. Everything you do for love, just double it and pass it back. Oh, someone tell me, capable to reciprocate, no matter how high or heavy the take, a stick of gold or dynamite, you could plead guilty and now we'll do the time.
Stick of Gum by Palestinian Canadian musician Nemesis. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman. In the weeks after President-elect Donald Trump's victory in the November election, he posted to Truth Social, quote, "Everybody wants to be my friend," as he was met by a steady stream of billionaires visiting him at his Florida Mar-a-Lago resort, some of whom had kept their distance during his first term, like Meta's Mark Zuckerberg and Amazon's Jeff Bezos, who owns the Washington Post. Now Bezos and Zuckerberg will join Tesla's and SpaceX's Elon Musk, who campaigned with Trump and is the world's richest man, on the dais Monday during Trump's inauguration. They're among the billionaires whose companies pumped a record amount of donations into the Trump-Vance Presidential Inaugural Committee. Apple, Chevron, Citigroup, Bank of America, Goldman Sachs, Google, Pfizer, Microsoft, and the pharmaceutical lobby also made major donations. Other ultra-millionaires and billionaires attending the inauguration will be those Trump has tapped to serve in his administration, alongside Elon Musk. For more, we're joined by Craig Holman, Public Citizens Capitol Hill lobbyist on ethics, lobbying, and campaign finance rules. His new report is titled "Corporations and Billionaires Funnel Millions into Trump Inauguration Committee." Craig, welcome back to Democracy Now! Give us a lay of the land. What's going to happen on Monday, and who's behind the money for this inauguration, and do we actually know at this point who's pouring in what?
Well, glad to be here.
But what we're seeing is the Trump inaugural committee shattering all previous records, both in terms of total spending on their inauguration and in the size of donations they're accepting from billionaires and corporations. First of all, the Trump inaugural committee set a target of $150 million, which would have broken the previous record of Trump's $107 million in 2017 to raise and spend on the inauguration. Then it went up, the funds just started flowing in to the coffers, and so the target went up to $200 million, and just a couple days ago, the target's increased now to $250 million. We're talking about $250 million to finance basically a party, which is absolutely outrageous. It literally, when you compare it to what other inaugural committees and other presidents have spent on their inaugural festivities, it just puts everybody it just lays waste to previous norms. Literally from Reagan to Bush, roughly about 20 to 30 million was spent on their inaugural activities. Obama bumped it up to about 50 million. Then Trump stepped in with his first one at $107 million and was largely criticized for that. And now we're talking about $250 million to celebrate the incoming president. What's even more concerning than the total amount being spent is the size of the donations that are coming in from corporations and billionaires, all of whom, just about all of whom, want something from the Trump administration. You know, we're taking a look at cryptocurrency. The cryptocurrency industry just came out of the woodwork. I mean, they hardly ever contributed to politics at all until 2020. And now they're pumping millions and millions and millions into the inauguration.
And Trump says he's going to issue an executive order on cryptocurrency on day one.
That's absolutely right. I mean, when you talk about what does this buy, I mean, you got Ripple, Coinbase, MoonPay, all these cryptocurrency businesses investing heavily in the inauguration. And Trump just recently announced that he's going to issue an executive order giving priority consideration to cryptocurrency. That means that federal agencies are going to have to take into consideration, figure out how to work with cryptocurrency. This is a dream come true. And, you know, prior to all this money coming in from the cryptocurrency industry, Trump was not a big defender of cryptocurrency. But suddenly he's in their laps at this point.
So maybe I don't have a big enough imagination, but how do you spend $250 million on a party? I mean, what are the rules and regulations, and where does this money go? It's not going to all go into Inauguration Day. Who gets it?
You know, we're not going to know in the end where much of that money goes. The rules for regulating inaugural fundraising activities are very, very minimal. There's only two rules of relevance. One is that a foreign national cannot contribute. Everyone else can. Every corporation, government contractor, billionaire, they can all give as much as they want. There's no limit on how much they can give. And the second rule is 90 days after the inauguration, the inaugural committee will release a record of donors of $200 or more to the inauguration. Now, that's just donors only. The disclosure records will not tell us how the money was spent, and so we're not going to know that. There's also no rules in effect as to how surplus funds are allocated. Yeah, you know, at $250 million, it isn't possible that the Trump inaugural committee can spend that much. Even back in 2017 with $107 million, they had a surplus with that. And I had written letters twice to the inaugural committee asking what's going on with the surplus funds, and never got an answer. They don't have to answer me. They don't have to tell us what they're going to do with the funds. The stories we're hearing in the press at this point is that some of the surplus may go to Trump's super PAC, some may go to the presidential library. But in the end, we really don't know. If they don't want to tell us where that money goes, we're not going to know.
So I want to ask you about the inaugural fund chairs. You've got the well-known millionaire, former Georgia Senator Kelly Loeffler, who's Trump's pick to be the head of the Small Business Administration, and a man who's very much been in the news over the last weeks, the real estate investor Steve Witkoff, who is the one who pressured Netanyahu to accept the ceasefire deal?
Yes, what we're seeing is the Trump nominees for all the various cabinet posts and senior positions tend to be his biggest donors. We see like Linda McMahon and Lutkin, from who were the head of the transition team, are being appointed as secretaries, cabinet officials. Elon Musk has worked himself into an advisory role, but Trump is even giving him an office in the White House. And by the way, I want to emphasize, in the advisory capacity, then Elon Musk no longer has to comply with strict ethics rules. So even though he has to disclose any conflicts of interest, he does not have to recuse himself from serious conflicts of interest or divest, which is an ideal position for Elon Musk. I mean, that way he gets to hang on to his money.
Why doesn't he have to reveal? You're talking about him and Vivek Ramaswamy heading up DOGE, right? The office on government efficiency, but it's not actually a real government office.
There's the code of ethics for an advisory position is very minimal. Now, Elon Musk does have to disclose his conflicts of interest, but he doesn't have to work out an arrangement to recuse himself from those conflicts if he can justify that the conflicts affect more than just him. If it goes beyond him to affect the whole industry like cryptocurrency, then it's fine. He doesn't have to recuse himself. He doesn't have to divest.
We just have a few minutes, and I want to get to a number of issues. One is you have proposed dealing with abuses of inaugural fund, you know, where that hundreds of millions of dollars will actually go, with a legit bill called the Inaugural Fund Integrity Act. 20 seconds on what that is.
That's right. The bill was just introduced yesterday by Representative Scanlon in the House, and I am working to try to find a Senate companion for the bill as well. That bill would actually bring together some reasonable regulations on the inaugural financing. You know, the inaugural financing has always been sort of an unregulated field, largely because no one really suspected it would become a playground for billionaires and government contractors to try to curry favor. What we're seeing this time around at $250 million, with all these special interests giving $1 million or more, that this is exactly what's going on. They are buying access, and with the hope of buying influence and public policies and government contracts. So now that we're seeing the abuses that are just phenomenal this time around, I'm hoping this legislation stands a good chance. It would set up, first of all, a ban on corporations making contributions, and that includes government contractors. It would set a contribution limit on individuals at $50,000, which is perfectly reasonable, even though in my mind kind of high, but at least it's better than $1 million or $5 million that we're seeing now. And it would require full disclosure of both expenditures and contributions to the inaugural committee. And it would set up rules as to how the surplus funds are dispensed. Surplus funds would have to be given to a legitimate nonprofit organization and cannot be used for personal benefit. So it's legislation that's needed. It's been introduced several times and hasn't gone very far. But with this record-breaking Trump inauguration, I suspect we're going to get we're going to get some legs behind this legislation this time around. I mean, this inauguration and the massive donors.
20 seconds.
You know, the executive order for the cryptocurrency industry just, you know, reflects that they are buying influence with the Trump administration. So we're going to see scandal after scandal follow this inauguration. And reform often comes on the heels of scandal.
Craig Holman, I want to thank you for being with us. We'll continue to follow this story. Public Citizens Capitol Hill lobbyist on ethics, lobbying, and campaign finance rules. We'll link to your report. Corporations and billionaires funnel millions into Trump Inauguration Committee. Next up, President Biden has made history, granting thousands of commutations, pardons, clemency. Will he grant clemency to the Native American leader Leonard Peltier, imprisoned for half a century? Stay with us.
Let yourself be heard this time.
Julie Cruz from the Twin Peaks soundtrack, iconoclastic director, transcendental meditation evangelist David Lynch passed away Thursday at the age of 78. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. There are just days left in President Biden's term. He has made history today, granting thousands of commutations, clemency overall, pardons in his last weeks. The question is, will he grant clemency to Leonard Peltier? Over 120 tribal leaders are calling on Biden to grant the indigenous leader, Leonard Peltier, clemency as one of his final acts in office. In a letter to Biden, the tribal leaders write, quote, "Our standing in the world as a champion of freedom, justice, and human rights cannot be maintained in a system that allows Leonard Peltier to die in prison." Leonard Peltier recently turned 80 years old. He spent a majority of his life, nearly half a century, in prison. For decades, he and his supporters have maintained Peltier's innocence over the 1975 killing of two FBI agents in a shootout on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota, and say his conviction was riddled with irregularities and prosecutorial misconduct. Federal government has been repeatedly accused of failing to prove its case against Peltier. The former U.S. attorney, James Reynolds, who was a federal prosecutor for the District of South Dakota and was involved in Peltier's prosecution, wrote to President Biden in 2021 advocating for Peltier's release. This is Reynolds reading a portion of that letter in a recent video produced by Preston Randolph.
President Joe Biden, I write today from a position rare for a former prosecutor to beseech you to commute the sentence of a man who I helped to put behind bars. Leonard Peltier's conviction and continued incarceration is a testament in a time and system of justice that is no longer has a place in our society. We were not able to prove that Mr. Peltier personally committed any offense on the reservation. As a result, Mr. Peltier's conviction now rests is that he was guilty of a murder simply because he was present on the reservation that day. He had served time for more than 46 years on the hands of minimal evidence, a result I strongly doubt would be upheld in any court today. I believe that a grant of executive clemency would serve the best interest of justice and the best interest of our country.
For more, we go to Rapid City, South Dakota, where we're joined by Nick Tilson, founder and CEO of NDN Collective. Tilson is among the more than 120 tribal leaders who issued a letter to Biden earlier this month as they continue to plead for Peltier's freedom, who's imprisoned in Florida right now. Nick Tilson, we only have a few minutes. Have you met with the pardon board?
We actually met with the pardon attorney. Liz Oyer, we met with the pardon attorney at the Department of Justice headquarters in December with tribal leaders from around the country, and talked specifically about Leonard Peltier and what this would mean for Indian country. And she was the one who was actually drafting the recommendation, because there will be a recommendation that goes from the Department of Justice to the president's desk. And now that recommendation has been made, and it's sitting on the press on the desk of the president right now, and he will make a decision in, you know, today or tomorrow, in the coming days, whether he's going to grant clemency to Leonard Peltier. And we don't know exactly what the recommendation is, but when we left that meeting, all of the tribal leaders, we felt like she was going to bring justice to Leonard Peltier, and we felt like it was going to be a recommendation for his release. And then the decision lies on the president.
So what did the pardon attorney tell you?
The pardon attorney told us that they knew the case inside and out, that one of the primary focuses of this particular meeting that we were sitting in is that the section of the recommendation that she wanted to work on was what this would mean for Indian country. What this would mean for Indian country if Leonard Peltier was released. And we talked in depth that the president of the United States issued an apology for the boarding schools, and that it so happens to be that America's longest incarcerated indigenous political prisoner in history is, in fact, a boarding school survivor, and that we need to see action from the president, and that this is also an issue that will help illuminate many of the other good things that the Biden administration has done for Indian people. She confirmed that, in fact, there was for sure going to be a written recommendation, and it was going to for sure go on to the president of the United States, and he was going to make a decision before he leaves office.
What is Leonard Peltier's condition in the Florida prison?
Leonard is 80% blind in one eye. He has type 2 diabetes. He's in a walker. He has an aortic aneurysm. His health is deteriorating, and that facility, quite frankly, doesn't even have the capability to meet his medical needs. And so it's absolutely a dire situation, and we need to get Leonard out of that prison, back home, and able to see a doctor almost immediately upon his release.
Can you tell me if the first ever U.S. cabinet, Native American cabinet member, Deb Haaland, the former Congress member from New Mexico, has weighed in?
She has weighed in directly to the president. You know, on the on Air Force One from Washington, D.C. to Arizona, when the announcement was going to be made for the apology for the boarding schools. She weighed in then. She's weighed in several times. And at this point in time, the president of the United States needs to listen to this matriarch and needs to listen to Secretary Deb Haaland. And because this is a priority for Indian country, and this is a perfect opportunity for the president of the United States to listen to the Honorable Secretary Haaland. And she has weighed in. She has not weighed in publicly, but she has weighed in directly to the president, as the Secretary of the Department of Interior.
I wanted to play a clip from, it was over 10 years ago when I talked to Leonard Peltier in prison on the phone. At the time, it was President Obama who was in office. Leonard, this is Amy Goodman from Democracy Now. I was
wondering.
Hi, I'm good. I was wondering if you have a message for President Obama.
I just hope he can,
stop the wars that are going on in the world, and stop getting killing all those people getting killed, and give the Black Hills back to my people, and turn me loose.
I thought it was very interesting, Nick Tilson, as we break away from that interview. People can hear the whole interview at democracynow.org. That when I asked him to comment, he didn't comment first on his own case. He talked about stopping the wars. If you can, in this last 30 seconds that we have, talk about what it would mean for Native America, for Indian country, for this country overall, for Leonard Peltier to be granted clemency.
You know, all throughout the history of the treatment of Indian people by the United States government, it has been one of injustice. And the reality is how Leonard Peltier was treated in his prosecution and incarceration is consistent with how this country has treated Indian people. And that's why all of us see a little bit of ourselves in Leonard Peltier. And that's why we fight so hard for him. So this is about Leonard's freedom, but this is about justice for Indian people everywhere. This is about human rights for people everywhere. This is about paving a path forward that gives us the opportunity to have justice and begin to heal the relationship between the United States government and Indian people. And so this decision is massive. And I really hope that the President of the United States weighs this decision.